Welcome to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. You are listening to a Trent presentation from November 2017. Mr. Alexander Duisberg, partner Bird & Bird LLP presents Smart Textiles, a New World of Data.
To the last part here, it's all about data. So I'm a partner at Bird & Bird. I'm a lawyer, a German lawyer working here in Munich. And I just thought it would be interesting to introducing you to a couple of the legal considerations which are widening up with wearables, smart textiles, stuff that you may not have on your radar as of now, but which will be quite interesting and relevant to your business as you go forward. And I thought the preceding presentation gave an excellent outlook of what could be out there for you. One of the key issues around that is really around data. So my intention is to walk you through a couple of the legal considerations and, you know, in terms of awareness creation, but also maybe some of the questions that you may have as we go along. So just feel free to raise questions as we talk, and whatever is unclear, just you know, let me know. A couple of things. I am following quite a lot of the developments in what you might call the data-driven economy, and we're seeing how it's spreading out into all sorts of industries, and some might be more advanced and some are just picking up. And I guess we've seen some of the things on the horizon just now, but obviously in the world of wearables, the fitness trackers and so forth, it's already very advanced. Nevertheless, for some of you, this may still be new. One of the legal questions that's typically raised is, you know, who owns the data? And we'll look into that just for a couple of minutes. And then I guess it's obvious, it's massively about privacy. Having wearables, smart textiles, which are somehow connected to devices, to apps, where at the end of the day there is a personal name behind an identity, triggers all sorts of privacy requirements. And we are right now in the phase of a big overhaul of privacy law. Some of you may have heard about the GDPR, which is the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, which is coming into force in May next year, and which means it's a real step change for many. So things around that would be relevant. Wherever you and your technical architects are discussing, okay, well, let's use the data and let's build apps and let's put it to the cloud, some of these aspects may be relevant. So it's really beyond the world of just fabric. And then we'll look into a little bit around issues around smart textiles and health data, which creates an additional layer of sensitivity. And believe it or not, all of this is hackable, so data security is a key point as well. So it's a whole bunch of legal considerations really wrapped around, weaved around data I'd like to, you know, introduce you to. And then there's other stuff. Other stuff which you may not be as aware of whenever you're putting chips or electronic devices into fabrics. There are all sorts of other regulations to consider. Some of you may be aware of that, and others may be less aware. So with that, let's just give it a go. And whenever you think there's a good point to raise a question, just feel free to do so. We're not an abundant group, so there's always time for that in any event. Let me just switch on my timer here so I can see that I keep a good pace. For all of you, as we go along, just bear a second. It's all about the data. So you could say we're weaving into the data economy just for our purposes here. But let me make it a bit more generic. And what we all know, and I think need to appreciate, there's a lot about this whole data hype, and people are saying, well, you know, it's the oil of the 21st century. You see those smart cities which are building up, and you have all sorts of connectivity at the level of infrastructure, at the level of personal usage, at the level of autonomous cars, smart homes, whatever you want, energy consumption, production, and so forth. I always tend to say, well, you know, the oil of the 21st century, that's nice and neat and fine. But a big difference to the real crude is, you know, that's getting less. The data is getting more. And that is the significant difference for everyone. And if you read about the exponential growth of data, you know, just to chime it in, the amount of data, if you like, bits and bytes, which have been generated over the last 2 years is more than has ever been generated before. And that seems to be almost the new Moore's law. So every 2 years, you will have like an exponential growth of the amount of data coming out there. That means we need to think about data differently, also from a commercial, from a legal perspective. Now, I guess we all appreciate data itself, that may be good and fine, but where is the value, and how does that play out? And you can look at these big data images, and you say, well, we only see the tip of the iceberg, and a lot is really about, you know, the unstructured data, the unknown out there, and how can you pool it, how can you extract value? But these are phenomena which are given, right? It's not something that is, you know, yet to be defined. We all need to appreciate this is happening, and this is not going away, right? This is not just like, okay, now it's a trend to talk about this, and in 5 years there will be something else. The amount of data is growing constantly, and the question obviously is, you know, who is able to make something out of it? Now, in our daily lives, I think we're all aware of some of the companies who have been extremely successful in building their business models on data. And I think it's very easy to answer right now. If you look at the highest stock price evaluations, it's the GAFA, right? It's the Google, the Apple, it's the Amazon and Facebook. They have built their business model on extracting value from data, mostly for the purposes of advertisement, but not all businesses, all models are the same. And you think about Amazon and Amazon Web Services, that's all, you know, built on data and infrastructure relating that to that. So there's a lot in there for everyone, and obviously there's a big question, you know, who will be the winners? Some of those companies are already on the winning side. But more than that, we're looking into a much more connected ecosystem. And that's, I think, the real difference for everyone. Traditionally, in traditional manufacturing and traditional textile industries, you would always think around a linear value chain, right? You would have suppliers, you would have someone who enhances the value, who creates the final product, who distributes it downstream, and you have that type of a market. What we already heard in the previous presentation, very much at the end, was it is much more about a collaborative context where you bring together technology, industry players from traditional industries, and you have a whole networked and connected environment, right? So the Internet of Things is obviously the, you know, one of the ways of describing what you see here, right? You have connectivity, you have data producers, you have devices, you have consumers, you have apps, obviously, you have platforms underlying there. All of this is building up, and to a large extent is already there. And it may be that, you know, one or the other of you is already there or is just starting to consider how to get into that. And so it's becoming much more complex than just, you know, producing smart fabrics and getting good marketing going to sell it. So that's something I think which is really a big change for many, for everyone actually. And obviously there are quite a few legal questions around that as well. And from a lawyer's perspective, and I've been in private practice now for 20 years, can say it's one of the most exciting and dynamic times for everyone, including for lawyers. Lawyers tend to be a little bit more the, you know, on the conservative side, a little bit more, you know, in the hindsight view. I've always been in technology law. I always enjoyed the forward-looking approach, and now it's becoming really very speedy and very dynamic. And it means not all rules are clearly set and defined. It's much more about developing parameter or developing practices, policies, ways of doing it. But there are certain areas of quite stringent legal demand around compliance, such as around privacy, what I will talk about to you in a couple of minutes. But if we think about this whole thing as an ecosystem which is building on data, or at least you're creating products which will be able to produce, to process, to transfer, to share, to make use of data, the question that is very often raised is, well, you know, how about ownership and data, right? You know, this is coming out of a device, it is coming out of a, you know, smartphone, it's coming out of a fabric, and is there a genuine ownership right in data? Very valid question. You know, going down a couple of miles here down the road to BMW or down to Ingolstadt, the car makers are all into that, right? They say, well, who owns the data that the sensors of the vehicles create? Now, for you, I'll walk you into one of the fundamental points around this, which comes maybe to some of you as a surprise, which is there is no ownership in data, right? There is no concept of civil ownership in data. So that is sometimes a bit of a shocking point, because everyone says, well, you know, I need to just think about whether it's mine or it's yours, and then we can maybe agree or find a way, or, you know, if it's yours, then I cannot use it, whatever. We need to recognize that the concept of civil ownership and data is not established, right? There is a historical reason for that, and I'm not just talking to you as a German lawyer. This is ubiquitous. This is everywhere, right? There is no law which has been made to define ownership and data. The historical background to this is, for example, in Germany, we have our civil code, and that's about 100 years, 120 years old. Well thought through code of law. Nobody ever at that time thought about data, of course. Nobody did. People are starting to talk about data maybe over the last 20 years, and the relevance of data as the raw material for business models, that's just happening now, right? If you look back, maybe it's Google who's been the first one to think about it, and Facebook quickly after. Those companies are around for less than 20 years. So that's the outset. It also means, and the reason is, put it out here, you know, we think about ownership in tangible goods like this. This can be subject to ownership, right? You can also think about copyright, right? Your music files, which you have on here, right? Well, copyright ownership, that's kind of halfway. Actually, if you are having music files on this here, you're typically not the owner of the copyright. That's, you know, the musician, the performing artist, the composer. And even then, you know, that's not exactly the same as ownership, but, you know, for the purpose of copyright, good enough. Now, with data, it's not automatic that you have copyright, right? Copyright means a certain level of creativity, right? The music file, the composer, there's a, you know, real thinking, some creativity, some personal creativity behind. Raw data generated from a sensor is not protected by copyright because it doesn't, you know, meet that threshold. So if we don't have ownership in data as such, you know, you can't just transfer it either. You know, if I could only transfer something to you if I own it, and I say, well, this is mine, we can agree, I sell it to you, you pay me a price, or I even can make a donation and, you know, get it for free, but then I transfer ownership. If I can't define ownership in data, I can't transfer ownership, right? Very interesting point, and actually quite mind-boggling, because then it raises the question, well, do we need this? Yeah? Should this be, you know, what are the lawyers good for if they don't even are able, you know, to define ownership and data? Well, let's wait and see. The other point, if you talk to data scientists or people who build business models based on data, say, well, it's not really about the individual one-off bit or the one set of data, it's more about the collection of data. That's actually what counts. And the potential to, you know, fertilize it with other information. So the value actually comes more out of the collection of data, the accumulation of data. If you think about my tip of the iceberg, it's not the one, you know, wrinkle in there, it's just, you know, the whole thing somehow. Which leads to one legal concept. If we had a lot of time, I'd talk you through all of this, you know, for hours. Database rights. Yeah, that exists, and that can be helpful. Database rights in the legal terms means it's a collection of electronically extractable information which follows a certain structure. So the practical example is the electronic telephone book, right? You're looking at the electronic telephone book or directory. You're not looking at the individual entry. You're looking at the way it's configured. You can do a reverse a search and those type of things. That would be protected. That type of analogy, that can be helpful in organizing flows of data, organizing possibly also licensing models. You know? So commercialization of collections of data would build on that. We can look into that in a bit more detail. So the question is, you know, do we have a flaw in the systems? As I said, you know, what are lawyers good for if they're even not able to define exclusivity rights in data? Well, I'm invited to a couple of government committees where we discuss this. And the prevailing view in the meantime is, no, it's not actually a good idea. The reason for that is data is different to tangible goods because economists call this data are a non-rivalrous good. They would say, you know, I can share it and I don't lose my usability. If I hand this over to you, I can no longer use this. right? Because then it's with you. If I share the data, I can copy it, you know, at zero cost practically, I can still use it. So maybe exclusivity, the traditional approach, is not the right thing. That doesn't mean, and that's one of the other areas of thinking, there couldn't be some very relevant information in data, for example, what you might call trade secrets. I've put a lot of thinking into collecting data, into structuring it, that's one thing, database rights, but there's actually material information, you know, information about my processes, about my production, about the product, about customer relations, all that stuff, that could be quite relevant to me. So trade secrets could be helpful, but it's not the same thing as ownership in data. So the current thinking is, well, we don't need exclusivity rights in data of a pure absolute right, ownership right. And we also see a lot of economy, a lot of business models evolving actually around the idea of sharing data, right? I have certain database, you have certain database. If we lump it together, we might be able to create something in addition. And actually, that's what the big ones are doing, right? They're extracting value because they're collecting data from different sources. And the big ones, they found that out early on. And that's why they're growing so exponentially. They know how to do it, right? But that doesn't mean it's only for them, right? There are many, many places to extract value from data. In practical lawyers' terms, it means if we don't have, like, you know, with copyright, we have an absolute right. We don't have that with data, then it's all about contracts. It's all about contracts agreeing on, I might have a source of data, or I might be producing data, I might be a consumer, you might be an operator of some kind of smart application which is attached to Fabrics, and you want to build a platform, you want to extract that data, well, you need to find a way to get it from me, you need to find a way to share it with others. We'll look at privacy in a minute, but that's the idea, a contractual framework. The relevance of platforms in that context is increasing. And that's something which is not, you know, just in the mind of a couple of lawyers. This is actually what the European Union is viewing, and they have set up a very thorough program, not in the sense of a bureaucratic overhead, but they're saying we need to understand better and find a way to help develop the European data economy, because we all appreciate that this is what is going to happen regardless, and we better try to be part of it. So they've set up a consultation process to deal with those issues, and they've established a few outcomes already. They've said, well, what we want to have in Europe is this free flow of data, right? Free flow of data means across inter-European borders. It comes close to something that they've turned out to be more precise on, actually, right, you know, just a few weeks back in September. Bring down geo-blocking. That's been discussed already. So the living example is, why can't I listen or see my Netflix outside of my home country, right? In my own language, right? So for example, if I go to Italy, I love to continue watching my whatever is House of Cards or whatever still is on in German or in English or whatever I preferred. However, if you have a geo-blocking barrier, it may be that you are not actually allowed to access this because the provider of that service is setting up artificial barriers. Now, that's going to come down because it's recognized for an open European market, we should not have those internal barriers. And there are numerous examples where that plays out, also in terms of regulations which may be in place and which should be brought down. Other areas are data access and transfer. Think about my car example. You might have some very strong players in the market. The example that's currently discussed is, you know, the car makers, they have all the data which is developed by sensors. How about the insurance companies? Shouldn't they have access to this to, you know, improve their insurance offerings? Well, if the car makers don't open up voluntarily, maybe you need regulation around that. Access to data. That's the topic here. Maybe not as relevant, you know, on the smaller, more granular level of a diversified market around textiles, but you think about some of the larger players, you know, the Adidas, the Nikes, and so forth. Well, you can think about those topics at least, you know. How about the secondary market, the supply market, you know, how do they actually interact with those large players? So freedom of data access and transfer, that's a criteria out here. Fair contracting terms, right? You know, I can't negotiate with Facebook, you know. They couldn't care less, right? But maybe Facebook or Amazon need to have fair terms around data exchange, right? So there could be that type of a thing. And the commission is taking an approach of, as they call it, the new approach, right? We want to find out. We don't want to make it up in our minds and then, you know, find out it's all wrong. We want to interact. We want to dialogue. So trade associations have a strong role to play here. And one aspect I've also picked up that will come up also in the privacy context more vividly, portability of data. Portability of data. That's a very interesting concept which has been developed in the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, so which will be in effect May next year. Whoever puts in data should be able to extract it and take it along and move it somewhere else, right? So it goes back to privacy rights, but it's a little bit wider than that. Portability of data, to give an example, I register with Facebook. Facebook knows everything about me. I might want to move to someone else. I want to move my profile somewhere else. So the commission has recognized, well, I can't do that. We need to help. We need to help. We need to create this right of portability. And then the question is, what can I port and what can I not port? What is it that I have input and so forth? Details to be looked at. But anyway, that brings us close to the privacy debate. But would you have any questions on the, let's say, the opening part? Just feel free. So privacy and consent. So I guess that's probably the most relevant area of law in the field of wearables. How do you do it? You know, when do you need consent? How do you actually procure consent? And how does it work? So I've put it a bit in simplified terms here. Consent, opt-in or opt-out, that's very much based, obviously, on the observation, market observations of what's happening and right now of how you actually get data. If you are the what we call the data controller, right, the entity which is actually extracting the data, you know, wants to control the data of individuals, what do they need to do to comply with the law? Let's walk into that quite briefly. Data protection is all about the individual. Data protection is a personality right. Originally, it has been developed in Germany, actually, going back about some 30 years or more on something like a microcensus judgment of our federal constitutional court. It's a personality right, and it is intended to protect the individual in its what we call the self-determination of about information. Now, that's like has been created in the Stone Age before we started talking about data more widely, but it's kind of been the lead concept leading into privacy law. What is it that we're trying to protect with privacy laws? Personal data. Personal data is, under European law, any information which is attached or gives insight about natural living persons, right? So anything that's capable of identifying a person or which in other ways contains information about that person falls under the definition of personal data. Those of you who might be coming from the United States might say, okay, PII, personal identifiable information, that's a bit more narrow. Personal data is very wide. So you see my example, IP addresses, right? So the stuff that you're leaving when you're kind of scrolling on websites, you know, your IP addresses, that can be considered personal data, right? That you wouldn't say that necessarily if you weren't a lawyer, right? You would say, okay, it's my name, it's my email address, my date of birth, whatever you know is really close to me. But no, it's much wider. And then we have particular categories of data, and we'll look at the health data, you know, a bit further down, as I mentioned. But, you know, ethnic origin, right? Sexual orientation, you know, health data, right? Religious confession, right? You think, oh, that's part of that is far away. Well, any of you who are operating in a German company will have your payroll processed, either through the company or an external service provider. And if you're a member of one of the churches, actually, your religious confession is in that, right? So all of a sudden, in a business context, this piece of information can be relevant. Means to say, these sensitive data pop up more often than not. And then we have one very relevant and very interesting part about, okay, well, then what is not personal data, right? What is anonymous data, right? Okay, first thing, not everything on the globe is personal data. So things coming out of sensors, let's say out of a motor engine monitoring sensor, that's not personal data, right? There's no person connected to that for the moment. And as well, there could be situations where you take out all identifiers, you anonymize personal data. And the question is, how do you do that, right? That would bring you outside of personal, out of privacy law, if I fully anonymize data. That could be easy. That could be, you know, more comfortable from a compliance perspective. Achieving that factually is not easy. It's actually rather tricky, because the thresholds of irreversibly deleting those identifiers are very high. And I'll show you in a second the solution is that the European lawmakers have been coming up with. But let's say we're dealing with personal data. Then there are two major columns or pillars on which you build your compliance. One is consent. I agree and I'm willing that my personal data, meaning to say the categories A, B, C, shall be processed by you for a certain purpose, and I'm fine with that. And they may also be transferred to another person, which is clearly identified, or company or so. So there is a basis of consent, or also statutory justification. Now, take my example that I am your employer. I shall know your name. I should also know your bank account and maybe your home address, because otherwise I can't pay you, right? I can't pay the salary. Now, I don't need your consent for that. That's clear. I don't need consent. The law recognizes that you're processing that data based on a statutory justification, which is called, performing the contract with the data subject. I need your bank account. That's your personal data. I pay you your salary. Thank you very much. No need for consent. But if I'm dealing with consent, it is the requirement of unambiguous, informed, freely given consent. That's not always easy. So does it mean in writing? Well, it could mean. How about if I'm on my, you know, in my mobile environment? Well, then consent in writing is not viable, but electronic consent is correct. And then we come to that, which I guess all of us have experienced, you know, the pre-ticked boxes, right? You know, and hereby I agree to receive newsletters, right? Pre-ticked. That would be what people call an opt-out, because it's already pre-ticked and you need to opt out to not receive newsletters, right? Doesn't work that way. That's against the law. You need to provide for an opt-in. But there are certain areas where you can also deal with an opt-out, particularly around cookies. Most people know what cookies are? Yeah, right? You never see them, right? But they're always there. Those things are dealt with you know, browser configurations and the way you get out of it. And you see one term here, I'll have it on another slide, e-privacy regulation. That's another piece of law we'll look at, but you know, not too much in detail. So if we're talking about data subjects, you're talking about access, information, correction, the right to be forgotten, which came out of a Google ruling a couple of years back, and data portability, I already spoke about that. Those are the data subject rights you need to warrant if you're processing personal data of individuals, right? Collecting them from a device and call your device a piece of fabric connected to an app. Yeah? You're actually dealing with these types of obligations under law. And then assume you're hosting your app, you know, not on your own server, but actually with Amazon Web Services, right? You need an agreement with Amazon Web Services. Now, they have that in place. It's called a so-called commission data processing agreement, right? Their service provider are handling data under your instructions, and you're the data controller as the company which is running the app and collecting data from devices or, you know, T-shirts with electronic chips inside. Very relevant also for cloud services. Additional layer of complexity, international transfers. What we as data protection lawyers call transfers means outside of the EU, right? Within the EU, we're all, you know, a big family, it's all harmonized. But if you move the data out to the US, people may have heard about safe harbor judgment, may have heard about privacy shield, complex stuff to keep the data within a level of compliance that's comparable to EU standards, right? Now, there may be companies who say, well, I don't like you. You know, I never liked Safe Harbor. I certainly don't like Privacy Shield. I'll just take the data. I don't care. That would not be good from your perspective if you're operating in the EU and transferring that data outside of the EU. And it doesn't really matter if you're a global corporation. You say, well, you know, I'm Levi's. I have my you know, my affiliates everywhere. I'm taking the data out in Germany, and then I'm sending it off to the US, and then on to China, and then on to Brazil. If I don't have that type of ecosystem around me, I would be breaching the law. And you may say, well, these things happen, but we're moving now into the time of the GDPR. This GDPR thing. Lawyers are talking just about that right now, right? Or at least a lot. And the main objective of the GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, has been creating a better harmonized framework. So what's been a good family so far in Europe means now we need to align even closer so it's all the same everywhere. Directly applicable, no local differences, at least in theory and mostly in practice either, neither. Modernizing data protection law, so right to be forgotten now has been kind of implemented. Stronger rights for data subjects, right? Damage claims, right? And enforcement. We'll see that in a second. Enforcement, a clear objective. This has always been kind of dealt with loosely, and now we need to make it hard law. And this is the real point where it's becoming touchy for any company. And the time is running, right? The clock is running. This is beginning on the 25th of May next year. So many companies are doing a lot about this right now. And this is just to show you, no need to really study this in detail. We had a directive in Europe since 1995, so 20 years back, when privacy was first put into this framework, and national member states created their own data protection laws based on this privacy directive. Now, they looked slightly different as it came out. But what you really see is data law has become more complex because our life has been become more complex around data. So that's the reason why things are becoming now ever increasingly relevant. And this is, you know, the big thing, what's happening. Enforcement will increase. Now, you see here, penalties may reach up to 4% of the aggregate turnover of a group of companies. So if you talk to Allianz, if you talk to Deutsche Bank, but you may also talk to Adidas or others, they think this is a lot of money if you get it wrong with privacy. And so for that reason, attention is now really fully onto this, to get it right. And it's not easy to get it right. Other things that are coming up, security breach rules, yeah, something that's been well established in the United States for certain categories of data, is now becoming more abundant in Europe. So hacking can trigger fines. And being hacked can also trigger fines even if you couldn't prevent it, because maybe you haven't reacted properly afterwards, you haven't notified, you haven't taken care of, you thought, well, we'll brush it under the carpet, who cares? That will not work, and that could trigger fines. And accountability. Being more documented about what you're doing. That's the new thing. You know, much more clarity, transparency, and documentation about how you process data. Pseudonymization, also a new thing. So anonymization, very difficult, you know, irrevocable retrieval from all personal identifiers. Pseudonymization means, okay, someone will be able to tell who I am, but at least I, you know, it's not so easy. It's kind of covered by pseudonyms. That can be very helpful, also for this whole big data thing. I already mentioned right of erasure, portability, new stuff under the GDPR. And concepts like privacy by design. This is very relevant at the chip level. Are you preparing technology which allows the user at the usage level to issue consent? Is the technology also protected against hacking? Is there an ecosystem behind which protects the privacy rights of the individual? That reaches into the conceptual phase. So it's something that is, in that sense, new and flowing directly into the process of developing and bringing to market certain products. Liability of data processors, that's something more on the, if you like, contractual level, which used to be dealt with in a different way. All those who are service providers become directly liable for things that they don't, you know, get right. And issues like codes of conduct and certifications. Codes of conduct, very interesting. What does it actually mean in a certain industry to do targeted advertisement, right, in the online marketing environment, you know? How do I draft my consent language? Is that something where I can, you know, adhere and can can commit to certain standards that have been established and recognized under a code of conduct. This is something new, which is now being developed, and some industries, some areas are already quite advanced in preparing for that. So afterwards, you as perhaps a small or a mid-sized enterprise don't need to reinvent the wheel, but you'll say, okay, I have this code of conduct, that's good for me, I will promise I stick to the code of conduct, and then I am already one step ahead in my compliance efforts. And e-privacy regulation. So that's all about, if you like, e-commerce related activities. It's a lot about cookies. It's a lot about, you know, content, metadata, all that stuff, you know, which is certainly very far away from just, you know, weaving fabrics, which will come into play. And it's explicitly addressed in the e-privacy regulation, which is currently in the drafting phase, that wearables are one of those areas where e-privacy rules will play a strong role. So again, something to watch out, and obviously quite relevant to seek legal advice well in advance before you just run out there. Let me carry on just a little bit to extend further. I already mentioned, you know, cloud, I mentioned Amazon Web Services, those type of things, platform providers who provide the infrastructure. Cloud, I think, is quite clear to everyone, is the way forward and is an easy access to scalability of processing personal data and, you know, running systems and so forth. And obviously, there are a few considerations around that, in particular for emerging business models to use the cloud technology at a very limited capital expenditure, actually just, you know, having operational expenditures for renting as you need a bandwidth and capacity. So very attractive at a low cost to achieve, you know, highly scalable usage and usability of technology. As well as also dealing with security, right? You know, as much as criticism there might be around, there are some around the suppliers, but you know, any Microsoft, any Amazon Web Services, any Oracle can invest so much more money into a security than any individual company could on its own of a smaller mid-size size. So very obvious that there are a lot of issues. But you know, as with any outsourcing, you know, think about it first what you're putting in the cloud, and don't think that that sorts itself out by itself. It needs a strategic and a planned approach. And of course, you know, wherever you're dealing with apps and processing data that you're extracting, you know, there's no other way nowadays, you would say, than storing, you know, no local storage of data in the textiles itself, obviously. So there is a diligence element around that. You know, choose your vendors. You know, not every vendor on a cloud solution is the same and good for you. And also from the legal side, there can be significant differences in terms of risk coverage, in terms of data exports outside of the EU. We see that most providers are now, particularly with eye to the German market, are focusing on providing local solutions because Germans tend to be very sensitive around this and say, well, it's not even as good to have the data hosted in Ireland. I really want to have it in Frankfurt on a data center. All that is available in the market, but it's something where you have a cross combination between, let's say, business commercial needs, technical needs, and legal assessment. So something you really need to weave into the equation. And sometimes, if you think about health data coming out of fitness apps, and you're saying, well, I really don't care, you know, and most users will not care if this just, you know, flings out to the US and then it's kind of, there's some kind of a maintenance service out there in India looking after it. Well, from a compliance perspective, if you are the company which is running the app and responsible for compliance, this may be a no-go, because all of a sudden you're dealing with health data, which you could not simply export without consent of the individual. And in many cases, consent would not be feasible, right? So those are things which you need to look at. And as well, from a compliance perspective, also looking at, you know, auditability. Are you able to maintain control from a privacy perspective over your suppliers, right? Not easy with cloud. You know, you can't just walk into the cloud and say, I'd like to look at that, right? This is too complex and it doesn't work, obviously. Also, it brings in conflict for the cloud suppliers because they need to keep secure their environment. They can't have tourists just walking in and say, well, I'd like to see my server rack. That doesn't work. So certification is one of the ways of dealing with the audit problem. And there are measures in place to make sure that we have a certification framework in the future when the GDPR enters into force. Maybe not from day one, but certainly in going forward. Health data. Health data comes up more often than not, if you like. And obviously, the fitness apps are a very good example for that. And I already spoke about the special categories of personal data, but they include, as you know, health data. And that could be any information about my health condition, right? So the step counter on my cell phone, is it tracking health data or is it just counting steps? Sometimes that's not easy to say, right? The pure steps, maybe not. But as soon as you measure it with other elements, probably yes. And so it's one of the areas, and there are other areas. Obviously, the fitness tracker is much more closer to that. It's taking your pulse. It's measuring all sorts of data points. That is health data, quite obviously. And if you think about fabrics, you think about the example we heard before, that you have, you know, body heat measurement, and you have you're tracking that information, humidity of the body. Well, that could be health data. So health data is not just, you know, am I sick or not? It's really what's my physical condition? And so those issues are relevant. And if this is the case, that I'm dealing with health data, well, my legal basis to deal with that, to collect that data, process that data, as long as I am a controller, which at some point am able to connect that with the name or the identity of the individual, is I need consent. Right? And that's not always easy to factor in the process, but you need to be aware that that is the relevant criteria. And if you don't, you run into all those problems of non-compliance. And then you go into all the stuff that, you know much better than I do here, but those issues about privacy by design, those may be, just some buzzwords right now, but they are becoming very relevant from a legal assessment perspective. So do think about that. The balance of negotiation powers, right? That could also be you in your supply chain to others, but it can also be you as, an end user-oriented business saying, well, this is the way we're going to do it. And obviously, I am defining terms and conditions on my wearable products, and I'll make it as tough as possible on the consumers. As long as they don't squeak, it's fine. Well, this is not the way it works under law. So you need that type of revision of your terms and conditions as appropriate. So those are issues, technical and organizational measures. What about data leakage, right? You need to look after that. If you are the entity which is in control of the data, you need to look after technical security, being protected against hacks as good as you can. And so forth, dealing with consumer questions, also on an ad hoc basis. So for wearables, I've just quoted this one here. We have a working group of our German data protection authorities. We have them spread out through our lender, and they get together and they pick up topics which they believe are relevant, and they've discussed wearables. And some of the principles you've just seen here are those which they've laid out in that document. Not a very lengthy document, but actually just relevant because they want to tell industry, these are the things you need to look after. Please make sure you work towards compliance on that. Otherwise, we will look after you. And with the increased enforcement under the GDPR, this could really turn to be an issue. So data security, just a quick touch point. Now, most of this is probably not as relevant, let's say, to the normal consumer-oriented businesses in the textile industry. But there could be angles where it does play out. Anyway, security is a key issue for management. Now, if you are collecting data, the CEO of Microsoft in Germany, of Amazon Web Services, he is on the line with his personal destiny to make sure he runs systems which are safe and secure, right? And it could end up in even personal liability if he gets it wrong. So this is the high-level thing. If you are a Deutsche Bank, and you are looking after the security of your company, you want to make sure it doesn't fall apart because someone hacks it, right? So that's one of the areas to look at. We also have the IT Security Act, which looks more or less at the providers of critical infrastructure. So most of this is probably not relevant, but I took out this one, right? Textile and automotive, right? The automotive suppliers, the automotive manufacturers, they are providers of critical infrastructure, right? So textiles built into cars, for example, could actually be an issue, right? What it means is if you are in a supply chain to automotive, they will impose those requirements on you as a supplier because they need to organize their whole ecosystem of supply according to those requirements. And then if things do go wrong, if you're hacked, the one thing, big takeaway I would say from today is don't rehearse during the crisis, right? This is too late. These things can be extremely tough on you, and they are very, very unpleasant, right? We've seen those things happen. There are some of the great, if you're ever interested in looking up on YouTube, the talk of the CEO of TalkTalk, right? A UK telecommunications operator. She was caught by a hack, and she was not able to convey a comforting message over TV, live TV. Look at her TalkTalk. It's a great message of how to get it wrong. And, you know, she was operating with best intentions, but she was unprepared for this situation. And that can ruin a company, at least the goodwill of a company. So some may be more exposed to this, others may be less exposed, but we all need to recognize there is no single company on the globe, let's say maybe with the exception of Mossad as an organization, who would not be hacked, right? Every company is more or less constantly under attack. The smaller and innovative you are, the higher the likelihood because you're actually not thinking about this as much. And this is because it's about your crown jewels, your know-how, your industrial property, but also about personal data, also about security, and these things as well. So, I am almost coming to a close. Now, I think I've given you a bit of a shockwave around data, but I just wanted to touch on a few final points which may also be a little bit more new for you guys if you're just, let's say, in the more traditional environment of textiles. Well, most of you probably know the CE marking. That's not very special. But who has seen the other three? Who knows the other three? Anyone? Rose, we, reach? Yeah, a little bit. Okay, great. This one, the Wii, you actually all know because if you ever buy a battery, you see it on there. Or some kind of electronic equipment, a torch, anything. It's about how can you throw this stuff away? Don't put it into your regular garbage. It needs special treatment. Now, if your devices are actually fabrics, textiles, and actually fall under that regulation, this is on you, right? And everything that's related to it. So let's not stop on this one, but this is clear for anyone who wants to get into the EU, you want to have that. But let's look at this. Waste of electrical and electronic equipment. We directive. There's liability attached to it, right? Whoever puts those products on the market and creates potentially hazard is in for it, is liable. So the whole intention is to prevent, reduce, and handle waste disposal of electronic equipment properly, right? Very obvious if you produce computers. Yeah, you never think about it because you already have it all set up. But you might be entering into this afresh, but say, this is my big future, and you just haven't had this on the radar. This is very relevant, right? And the chip and the fabric actually will qualify in the greater likelihood as electronic equipment. There's no, it's like, you know, low voltage minimum threshold and this doesn't matter, right? You know, don't try to put 1,500 voltage through a t-shirt, but actually, you know, it's everything, right? High volume, low volume. So you will fall into that if you are doing all of this. And in Germany, it's then dealt with within the Electronic Gerätegesetz. You have registration, you need to set up a concept of waste disposal, and you could say, well, I've sold this stuff, you know, how do I take it back? Yes, you will be under those obligations, right? So there's investment out there, as well as also potential fines and something you want to be aware of. And then also on substances, right? Hazardous substances, I've just put it out here. So lead, mercury, cadmium, you know, all those substances, you know, which, you know, might be coming out of other places in the world, built into fabrics. You say, well, let's take it from Asia. It's very convenient, low priced. We'll just get it in. It's very neat and smart. And you haven't thought about this. That is a problem. And it can be a serious problem. And once these products are out in the market, you cannot say, it's off my hands. You would find yourself in situations of product recall like large automobile providers or manufacturers. That's not an easy call, right? So this needs to be looked at with foresight, as well as also some of the chemicals, which, you know, in essence is probably something that you've been looking at one way or the other already. So I think with that, I can close. And actually, it's good timing because we are at a close. I think what I just want to bring across, as much as in many other industries, data will be one of the key drivers of economic success, not just of organizing yourselves, but actually doing something with data that you're able to collect from smart devices, including textiles. Privacy is key to make that happen. GDPR and the e-privacy regulation are now really pending. E-privacy regulation will come out in a final form soon in the next couple of months. It's something to prepare for now. It's not like, I've only heard about it now, let me give it another 2 or 3 years of thought, and then I'll see how I get, you know, arranged and I'll have it all in place. The authorities will look after that once the starting line is reached. And if I said privacy is key, well, security is even more key, right? So do take that very seriously whenever you are actually managing, hosting, and dealing with data, and do also think about the wider regulatory environment. And with that, I'd like to come to a close. Thank you very much and for bearing with me. This is the law firm I work for, well-recognized in the technology field, and there we are. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. To get your free ticket for the next fair or listen to other presentations, go to performancedays.com. Copyright November 2017 by Design and Development GmbH Textile Consult. All rights are reserved.